Welcome to the Add Up Experience Legal Podcast. I'm your host, Deborah Solmore. It's been a very busy week at the Supreme Court and a busy week for decisions that impact higher education. As has been widely reported, yesterday, the court issued its long-awaited decision in the cases related to the admissions policies used by Harvard and the University of North Carolina as they relate to consideration of an applicant's race. The court held that both policies violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution. I'm honored today to have as my guest Therese King Nohost, the General Counsel for Governor State University, one of the Illinois public institutions. So welcome, Therese. How are you today?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing really well. Thank you.
So it's been a very, very busy week for us in the higher education space, huh?
Yes, it's hard to keep up with these lengthy opinions coming out.
So we had the opportunity to catch up this week at the NACUA conference where we gathered with our other higher education colleagues. And then the decision came out while we were there. So there was a lot of discussion about the decision yesterday and today. So I'm looking forward to discussing it with you in a one-on-one setting like this.
Thank you. Me too. Yeah, there was a lot of buzz coming out yesterday with all the different decisions.
So as I think I explained to you, my goal in this podcast is to really bring the legal, regulatory, and compliance issues that face us in the higher ed space to a broad audience and spotlighting and showcasing lawyers who don't talk like lawyers. So I know that the decision's been widely reported. So I'm going to ask first if you could sort of just give your sort of summary of what the decision was and what it means to the higher education community.
Sure. I know a lot has been written about this, but you know, at a very high level, the case looked at two universities' admissions policies, Harvard and the University of North Carolina. Both have a very selective admissions process, and both have a very detailed process for how they make their selections for admissions. And one of the many factors each of them had been considering is the race of the applicants. So they were engaging in what we would call race-conscious admissions practices. And the Supreme Court ruled in its majority opinion that consideration of race was not consistent with the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So it essentially held consideration of race in the admissions process as unconstitutional.
And this, did this come as a surprise to people who were following the case?
I feel like that's a little bit of a trick question. it came as a surprise to me looking at the cases that came before it. There is a lot of Supreme Court precedent preceding this opinion, going back all the way, 45 years, holding that race can be one factor if considered as part of a holistic admissions process. So to see that upended was surprising to me. But unfortunately, I think the makeup of the court has changed. It's become much more conservative in the past couple of years. So given the conservative leaning towards the court, I don't think this is really a surprise given their political leanings.
And for those sort of non-legal scholars out there, what is the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution? What does it mean? What is it supposed to mean?
So, that was sort of one of the questions that the dissent and the majority grappled with. I mean, the majority took the position that the Equal Protection Clause is colorblind and means that it means equality for all races. And the dissent took a very different perspective that the 14th Amendment was enacted in the shadow of the Civil War and getting rid of slavery in the United States. And so it's not pure equality. It's more about equity and more about making up for the systemic racism this country has suffered.
Now, I know in the coming days and weeks, there'll be a lot written and a lot spoken about what does the opinion mean and is it based on current law? Does it go against current law? So I will leave that for the pundits for a little while. But I wanted to ask you, how, if at all, does this decision impact your institution?
Well, Governor State is a little bit of an unusual university in that we're a minority serving institution, which means over half of our student population comes from one or more minorities groups. So we have a very strong Black or African American population. We have a very strong Hispanic population or Latinx population. And we've achieved that, fortunately, without engaging in race conscious admissions practices. It's just sort of diversity is sort of built into our DNA. So this won't change our admissions practices. And I would say for the majority of universities out there that don't have highly selective, you know, admitting 10%, 5% of applicants, this isn't going to change their admissions practices either. But for those that do, and for those students who are shooting for the highly selective universities like the Harvards, this comes as a real blow and a real disappointment for them.
And I think the opinion had some statistics that suggest that most institutions do not use a race-conscious admissions policy. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the majority noted that only, I think they said two-fifths, which is about 40% of institutions have race-conscious admissions. One thing that's important to note, and I know this is not supposed to be a super legal discussion, but
that's okay. We're both lawyers. I think sometimes we just can't help that.
Right. You know, I talked about this having to do with the constitutionality, and usually we think of the Constitution as being applicable to state actors. This is going to apply both to public and private institutions. And that's because the private institutions, like your Harvards, agree to abide by Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which has the same standard as the Equal Protection Clause. So public and private will have seen impact from this decision.
And I think the opinion notes that in Wharton Law School, we were led to believe is the really important parts of the opinions, which are the footnotes,
yes.
that the standard, the constitutional standard and Title VI standard are very similar, are the same. So therefore, the court spends most of its time talking about the Constitution and not Title VI.
Correct. I mean, Justice Gorsuch did a whole concurring opinion on Title VI, but yes, the long and short of it is privates will be impacted as well.
So, and I think the point that you're trying to make is that this applies across the board to all institutions that have been or would want to use a race-conscious admissions policy.
Correct. Correct. Public and private.
So I guess the next question would be, was there any glimmer of hope, anything in the opinion that people could hang their hats on to think about what do they do next? We're you know, very close to the next and the upcoming admission cycle. We could talk a little bit about the Department of Ed issuing a statement that says it's going to be giving some guidelines within the next 45 days. But what is in the opinion that, you know, people at institutions and admissions teams can use to figure out what to do next?
So even though the majority talks about the Constitution being colorblind, it did hold out a little reed to rest upon. And it's, I think it was the very last paragraph or second to last paragraph of a very lengthy decision where they talked about you still can't consider race in and of itself as a factor, but you can consider on an individual basis how their lived experience has affected them. So for example, they talked about, you know, someone who has overcome discrimination based on their race might be able to draw a parallel in an essay between that discrimination and overcoming their discrimination with their courage, for example. So I think you will see universities trying to ride that fine line of how they can use their essay questions to allow people to express how their race has had an impact on their life and how that would add to the diversity of an institution's student body.
From a lawyer's standpoint, I thought that paragraph was interesting because we tend to talk about the recitation of the facts of a case, the holding, which is the court's opinion or the court's decision, and then what we refer to as dicta, everything else that's in there that just sort of guides you. And to finish the opinion, to say, oh, by the way, here's some suggestions for you. Here's some things that you can do. While I guess helpful, did strike me as a little odd.
Yeah, I can't guess why they put that in. Maybe it was to address some of the dissent's criticism. But I think that's where the discussion is going to focus in the months to come, is how do universities look at the individual's experience and allow them to express how their race has had an impact on their individual experience. I think that's where all of the conversation is going to be for institutions and trying to figure out how to thread that very fine needle.
I heard some discussion while we were at the NACUA conference about those schools that use what we refer to as the Common App. So, an application that many of the schools use, and an individual institution can have sort of its own section of essays, and talking about that it is likely that the Common App will stay the same, and these wading into these waters about what you can and cannot ask in light of this decision will fall to the individual institutions. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think sadly, the inst I think trying to thread that needle means the institutions who try to do that will have a little bit of a target on their back. And so I think it'll be your bigger or your well-funded institutions that have the resources to fight that fight who will be going out on a limb. Your lower, less funded, the Common App probably won't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. I mean, they're not going to want to litigate that issue on behalf of all the institutions. So, the universities who go that route will have to have some courage and some be able to probably stomach some criticism and some objections to that.
After I finish reading a Supreme Court opinion and have digested the holding and sort of think about the implications for the issue that the courts decided, I always think to myself, well, you answered one question, but there are 10 more questions that you either didn't answer or that are going to arise as lawyers try to implement the court's decision. So I wanted to sort of shift topics for a minute and talk about maybe some of the things that are left unanswered by this opinion, and one of them being institutions that have race-based scholarships or that consider race as a factor in evaluating scholarships. And how, if at all, do you think that the opinion will impact the way institutions think about scholarships?
Well, I think this will have a huge ripple effect on scholarships. I also worry about internships that are trying to create pathways for or pipelines for people of color. I think those are both in jeopardy right now. The Office of Civil Rights of the Department of Education has already made clear in the Title IX con in the Title IX realm that it doesn't favor having gender-based scholarships. And so I don't think it's a huge leap in light of this decision that you're not going to be seeing race-based or race-favored or preferenced scholarships. And I think the same is probably true for internships and the like.
When you give me a little bit more context, when you're talking about internships, what are your worries with respect to internships?
Well, I mean, I think that there are certain areas where minority students are underrepresented in STEM fields in particular, finance. And so to the extent that those employers are looking to institutions like ours or looking to the super highly selective Ivies to create a pipeline of diverse candidates, I don't know that they'll be able to do that expressly. I think that those internships will have to be open to all candidates regardless of race. So that'll be I think a loss in terms of diversity for those positions and opportunity.
So lots to stay tuned for to stay tuned on for this decision.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So one of the last things I want to cover is really not related to the necessary the holding of the decision, but really the number of separate opinions that were written. So in this case, we had, six of the nine justices wrote either in concurrence or dissent. Obviously, Chief Justice Roberts authored the opinion. Do you have any thoughts about sort of the way the court is, the direction that the court is moving in each of the members of the court sort of taking a lot of time to separately write. I mean, this opinion all told made up, I think, something like 237 pages. And that kind of struck me when I read the opinion, all 237 pages of it, by the way.
It was extraordinary in its scope. And the fact that there were so many separate voices, I think, is telling of the shift in the court. The court has looked at this issue before. It looked at it in Grutter in the early 2000s and reached the polar opposite conclusion than the majority did here. The Grutter court held that diversity in and of itself is a compelling interest in the educational sector. Here they reached the opposite conclusion, holding that, you know, that was unmeasurable and imponderable. I can't resolve that tension between those two decisions without looking at the makeup of the court and just looking at the majority now is very clearly a conservative majority. And that was not the case when Grutter was decided.
And I know we talked about this a little bit before we went on air, and I am not going to put you on the spot for the decision that was handed down, the two decisions that were handed down today in the Brown case and the Biden versus Nebraska case, wherein the court invalidated President Biden's student loan discharge program. But the second to last paragraph of that opinion sort of struck me as playing to this topic that we're discussing, where just also authored by Justice Roberts, where he talks about that he says it's become a disturbing feature of some recent opinions to criticize the decisions which with justices disagree as going beyond the proper role of the judiciary. He talks a little bit about the decision that they were deciding in there, and he ends the opinion by saying, we do not mistake this plainly heartfelt disagreement for disparagement. It is important that the public not be misled either. Any such misperception would be harmful to this institution and our country. And I found that to be very interesting in light of how we think about the court as being insulated and not speaking publicly about its inner workings. And here was the last opinion of the term authored by the Chief Justice, concluding the opinion by talking about the fact that while the justices may be disagreeing in writing, that for the public's perception, we should not be reading that the justices are personally disagreeing with each other or that somehow there should be a negative perception given by the readership. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I know I put you on the spot raising it right before we got on, but.
Yeah, no, I was taken aback a bit by the vitriolic might seem a little strong, but there definitely seemed there was a biting nature to some of the dissents and the majority's opinions going back and forth about, you know, the dissent says this and this is why they're wrong and the majority says that and this is why they're wrong. Reading the dissent's opinion, this is clearly a very emotional issue for all a lot of Americans, you know. Yes. And to take that out of it and say that the Constitution is colorblind, I think it's a very hot issue. And you see that coming through in the way that they're, you know, talking to each other through their respective opinions. So maybe Chief Justice Roberts was trying to massage the public that there's nothing to worry about here. Go about your business. But I was a little disturbed reading the opinion, seeing that level of conflict with the court.
I would agree with that. As we wrap up, is there anything else you want to share? Any predictions you might have for where this goes next, or maybe some tips for our admissions teams as they're trying to figure out what to do next if they are at an institution that the decision impacts?
Yeah, I would just keep an eye out for that Biden guidance that he's promised. I was really happy and pleased that the Department of Education was so prompt in its response to that and its offer and promise to offer more firm guidance to the institutions, because I think the majority opinion really did leave people in a little bit of a lurch with that last paragraph of how do we apply that. So getting concrete guidance, I think, from the Biden administration will be very helpful. And I think, you know, we just need to continually focus on diversity, equity, inclusion with other means, you know, whether that's looking at diversity in terms of socioeconomics and the socioeconomic structure of or the financial aid eligibility of your students, maybe looking at our history of allowing legacy candidates at really selective schools. There are a lot of levers that can be pulled. This isn't the only one to create diversity. So while I think it's a disappointment for sure, you know, there are other pathways to diversity that I think institutions need to be really creative in exploring.
And I would say, you know, a disappointing opinion overall, but I think we can end the podcast on sort of that upbeat note that there are levers out there. And it will take, you know, all of us creative lawyers to figure out which they are and how to pull them. So thank you. I appreciate you taking the time. And always, I love talking to you. And I always appreciate your insight.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.